This is Meatless, a podcast about eating. I'm Alicia Kennedy, a food and drink writer. I'll be having conversations with chefs, writers, and more about how their personal and political beliefs determine whether or not they eat meat. The show will ask the question, how do identity, culture, economics, and history affect a diet? In this episode, I talked to Soleil Ho, food writer, host of Bitch Media's Popaganda podcast, and co-host of the Racist Sandwich podcast. She has co-authored a graphic novel called Meal with Blue Deliconti that will be out October 1st from Iron Circus Comics. It follows the professional and romantic life of a young chef who's obsessed with entomophagy, the eating of insects, a field Soleil has become an expert in. We talked about the book, the tech industry's obsession with cricket flour, and what it all means for vegans and vegetarians.
Hi, Soleil. Thank you so much for being on Meatless with me.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited. I'm such a fan.
I'm such a huge fan of you. And as again, I think when we met in real life, I was like, your voice is just like it is on the radio. And again, I'm just like, oh, it's Racist Sandwich is happening. So this is actually my first episode that I'm doing not in person. Can you tell me where you are right now geographically?
Yeah. So I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota right now in my bedroom closet.
Wonderful. Yeah. I'm in Houston, Texas, actually, to tell everyone, which because that's not normal for me. We're gonna do this on Skype. Can you tell me about where you grew up and what you ate?
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and we mainly ate, well, okay. So my mom was a single mom for most of my life. And she worked in the fashion industry. So she was super busy all the time. And so when she would get home, you know, pretty frequently she would pull out the drawer of menus and kind of fan them out in front of my sister and I and just say like, pick one, you know? And so, you know, we got a lot of delivery. So like Chinese, Indian, Vietnamese, Thai. So that was kind of the bulk of our daily foods. But then she would make all kinds of things. She was really much, she was the kind of person who would keep like the gourmet recipe books, you know, mm-hmm. She loves that stuff, or like the Williams-Sonoma, like, cookbooks that they have for like soup or hors d'oeuvres and things like that. She was an experimenter.
So that sounds like a very like New York City way of growing up to eat a ton of delivery.
It definitely was.
And I love those Williams Sonoma cookbooks. Yeah. Those were such a staple of that, of like when we grew up, the teaching people how to cook through Williams Sonoma, which I always felt was so classy. Like when I went to the mall, I was like, oh, this is life here.
I mean, I loved tasting all the oils and the vinegars and the bread cubes. Like that was a highlight of the weekend.
So you've been on a few sides of the food world. You've been a chef, you're a writer, you have Racist Sandwich, and you're also the host of Popaganda. But how and when in your life did you know that food would be your professional focus?
Honestly, it was when I graduated from college, and I graduated in 2009, that's when the recession really hit, right? The economy mm-hmm. tanked. And I had sort of like vague notions of going into academia or working for a museum because I was a history major and I was really excited about like research. And that sort of closed up when I realized slowly that I wasn't going to be able to get a job in any of the fields for which my bachelor's degree prepared me. So I went into farming. I started woofing, you know. So I signed up with the Worldwide Opportunities on Organic Farms. And so I just was an intern on a farm for a season. And it was really inspiring. You know, like the actual farm part, the farmer was kind of a super duper Catholic and it was not quite like the most compatible workplace. But working with vegetables and working with animals and, you know, working with food on this intimate level that I'd never really experienced before, that was like really, really important to me. And so after the season, I started interning at restaurants in Minneapolis and writing about food on my off time too, just kind of like, I don't know, use my degree a little bit and use my training a little bit. And so, yeah, from there, it just was a constant in my life until today.
Amazing. And you co-wrote a new book, Meal, with Blue Delaquante, and it focuses on entomophagy, which is the eating of insects. How did this project come about?
So, yeah, Blue reached out to me. I had been a fan of her work, and she'd been a fan of mine, but we never really talked. But Blue reached out to me out of nowhere, mm-hmm. essentially, last year, to ask if I'd be interested in working on this book project. And she had already written the bulk of the script, honestly, and she wanted me essentially to be a sensitivity reader, mm-hmm. but also to, like, add chunks to it, so, like, a little bit more involved than just reading. Right. And so, yeah, like, we talked it over, you know. I had never really thought too hard about entomophagy before. Mm-hmm. I had, like, absorbed all the rhetoric, and I had eaten insects before, but I never really thought about it. And the way the book tackles it was so interesting to me. Just the idea that, like, we talk a lot about how insects are a really good protein source, the food of the future, blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. But we don't really pay much due diligence to the cultures and the traditional food ways from mm-hmm. which these insects came. And, of course, that is, like, exactly my wheelhouse. So I was, like, all aboard, you know. I was super excited about that part of it. And so, just from doing that, I started doing more research into, like, who eats bugs, why do they eat bugs, you know, where. And I just became obsessed. And so over the course of the year, you know, collaborating with Blue and, like, adding bits and pieces, developing, you know, ideas in this book, I learned a lot. And I'm a huge fan now of just people who eat bugs. I think they're really cool.
And are you doing any more work on this subject now that you've kind of immersed yourself in it?
Yeah. So I had a lot of research on my hands that I had done just reading and reporting for the book that just never made it in because, you know, it is like a fiction book. Mm-hmm. Like it's not a research paper.
Right.
And so I had all of this stuff in my files and all of these thoughts. And so I sent all of that to UC Berkeley, who had this, like, food and farming fellowship with Malia Wolin and Michael Pollan. And so I was like, hey, like, can you give me money to just investigate bugs? And so they said yes. And so I'm reporting out a story about entomophagy in central Japan, which I'm super excited about. I'm going in the fall to this landlocked region in the province Gifu, where they eat wasps. It's really hard to say wasp. Where they eat wasps. And bear hornets as well, like the giant hornets that are about, like, inch and a half, 2 inches long.
Yeah.
So I'm super stoked about it. Just, I'll be making some audio and doing some writing, and hopefully someone will pick up the story.
Amazing. And I remember reading in the book that tarantulas taste like seafood. Have you tasted a tarantula?
I have tasted a leg, yes.
Okay.
It tastes a lot like, especially when you batter and fry it, it ends up tasting a lot like a soft shell crab, which is, like, one of my favorite foods. So I love tarantula.
That's amazing.
I think I can just say it. Yeah.
Where is that traditionally consumed?
In Cambodia.
Okay, cool. So you kind of touched on this, but I have personally only encountered arguments around eating insects from, like, techie entrepreneurs who want you to buy their cricket flower energy balls. And it's very, you know, dystopian in my view. But in Meal, you present such kind of an exciting historical, cultural, and culinary perspective. And there's a little about how insects could be the way for future populations to sustainably get protein, but unlike with the tech people, it's not the focus. I wanted to get what you think about that kind of techie context in which the eating insects has fallen in the mainstream, sort of, and is, you know, it's super white, and but that's gotten more attention than, you know, the tarantulas that taste like seafood that are traditionally eaten in Cambodia. Like, you know, why are we talking about energy balls when we could be talking about that?
Right. Yeah. So The main reason is that I think we are very much invested. We, as in like just people who are thinking about food, right, in Western culture, we're very much invested in appealing to an audience, like a perceived audience of white, upper middle class consumers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like for that reason, crickets and grasshoppers are the face of entomophagy in the West because they're very friendly. You know, they're very PR ready. Media savvy insects, unlike tarantulas, unlike, you know, flies or grubs. I think they're just an easier sell, you know, for a variety of reasons, but they're less hostile. You know, they're very, focus grouped in a sense.
Yes.
And so one thing that I found really interesting in my investigations and my research was, you know, there are these like really interesting tech led initiatives to ranch them, essentially, to raise crickets in the U.S. And so they have these facilities that can raise, like, a billion individuals at a time. And, like, that boggles the mind, right? Like, a billion creatures in this building. And they are working on ways to automate that, too, because crickets are nocturnal, and so you have to feed them at night. And, you know, it's harder to pay people, like staff, to work overnight. So it's a lot easier to just feed them with robots. Mm-hmm. And so there's, like, all of that stuff, too, going on. So one thing that I find really troubling about that is the idea of a monoculture, which I think if we want to talk like honestly about sustainability, we can't have more monocultures. Right. Like that is just not going to work. You know, if the cricket collapses and we get into this position where like we are dependent on crickets, you know, what's going to happen? You know, it's, and if you're raising a billion individuals in one building, disease is going to spread really, really fast, especially if they're all the same species.
Right.
And so, like, those sorts of considerations, we're not seeing too much, like, discussion of. But, like, that's one thing that I'm afraid of because we're so overly invested in appealing to this consumer who's afraid of, like, spiders.
Right, right.
You know?
Right.
So there's that little bit of it. And then one thing I found fascinating in the course of working on this book was the idea that insects are going to feed the world.
Right.
You know, like, because they're so efficient to raise and like, all that stuff. But the central contradiction to that is that the majority of the world eats insects.
Right.
They already do. And the initiatives that are bandying about this rhetoric are the ones that are selling this, you know, very premium priced product to people in like Silicon Valley who are not in want of food. And so like, there's that contradiction to me is like, they're invested in feeding the world, but they're not actually feeding the world.
Right.
You know, for the most part,
right.
There are some organizations that have opened up like processing plants and factories like outside of the US, which is great. But like the majority are just like making like, you know, super fancy, exotic foods, essentially, for people with money. And so, like, that was the weird part for me, is, like, why do we care that Westerners are eating bugs? Because we're not the ones with the problem. We're not the ones who actually have to, like, we're not at the front lines of the overpopulation debate or, like, you know, scarcity or, like, water wars or any of that stuff, right?
Right.
Like, we are pretty well insulated by design. And so it seems intellectually dishonest to me.
Yeah. Why do you think that people... Yeah, but you wrote about sort of in a similar vein, your recent Taste piece about the consumption of dog meat and the racist perceptions around that. As someone who doesn't eat meat, like I read that and was just like, well, thank God someone is pointing this out, because, you know, the hypocrisy around the way people talk about various animals is just, no one really considers it in the way that you did. And there's kind of a similar thing, like this obsession with who eats what makes it more legitimate in a way. And I don't, do you see that these things kind of relate to each other at all?
Yeah, especially along the lines of like otherizing, right? And like, using food to cast someone else as a barbarian or inferior. And so, like, yes, with dogs, like, it's been used, it's been weaponized. Like, mm-hmm. the act of eating dogs has been weaponized against East Asians, Southeast Asians, Pacific Islanders, especially in war and just in, like, acts of imperialism. Like, it's been a tool to illustrate how backwards people like me are. And, you know, it's a practice that's, like, pretty regional. It's pretty, it's not a universal thing in those regions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, using that to justify westernization, intervention, you know, all of that stuff has been really, like, blatant, right? And so the same applies to insects, where, you know, people associate insect eaters with, like, dirtiness and, like, poverty. And that's, you know, that's a big, like, stereotype of people who eat bugs. It's like they eat them because they're desperate. You know, they eat them because they don't know better, or they can't eat chicken or whatever. When that's not really the truth, you know. There's this great example in the book about tarantulas, actually. You know, we've been talking about tarantulas, but there's a stereotype that people started eating them during the, like, Khmer Rouge regime, and, you know, because there was no food. But that ignores the fact that people have been eating those tarantulas even before that regime. Like, it was a delicacy. And so, like, there's that notion of, like, who can be a gourmand and why?
Right.
Like, people in Cambodia can appreciate tarantulas for their taste, for their delicate flavor, for the way they cook. And, you know, they don't only eat out of, like, this animalistic instinct for protein.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I know that you're not a vegetarian or vegan, but there is, you know, a bit of a discussion now that this is becoming more of a conversation around whether insects count sort of as meat. And I recently was offered some ants to pair with a cachaça, and was told, oh, you must have the ants with the cachaça, or you can't really understand the cachaça. And I was like, and someone else was like, no, she's vegan. And I was like, you know what, if I can't understand cachaça without eating the ants, I'm just going to eat the ants right now. But I didn't feel, like, great about it as a person who, you know, I'm navigating right now, like, my own limits with meat and with animal products right now. And, you know, when I ate them, I was like, I don't know if I want to do that. But I think I'm interested in, like, even though this isn't, like, your world really of, like, being vegetarian or vegan, but, like, what do you think? Like, if you had a vegan friend who came to you and was like, I just don't know if I should eat, you know, some cricket flour. If that seems like a sustainable way to eat protein, then maybe I should. But, you know, what is your take on that?
Oh, man. I guess I don't feel very good about telling people. I don't know. I'm not, like, the morality police.
Of course,
by any means. even though people try to pretend I am, I'm not, and I'm flawed in that way. But I do think that, you know, if you are a vegan because you don't want to take life, like, that is, you know, like, a pound of cricket flour, I believe, contains, like, thousands and thousands of individuals. Mm-hmm. Like, the scale of life taking in a pound of cricket flour is, like, extremely high. If you want to think about numbers, right. Mm-hmm. Versus, like, a single steak. So it's hard, right? It's like a weird thing to grapple with, because with insects, especially, like, it's hard to think of them as individuals, as, like, alive.
Right.
And, that's why it's so easy to kill them. Right. And so if you want to think about it as far as, like, a harm done sort of thing.
Right.
I don't know. It gets really sticky, right?
Yeah. Oh, it does. I mean, I felt bad about eating the ants, but yesterday I slapped a mosquito that was on my boyfriend's forehead. So, you know, like, where do we draw lines? Like, cause I killed that mosquito on instinct. I was just like, you have to die. Would I feel bad about eating cricket flour? Yeah. I don't know. It's, these are the things we must ask ourselves. But yeah, so to kind of go back to some more political type issues, I guess, we talk a lot on this podcast about veganism's like whiteness. So I would love, I always want to get like outsider kind of perspective on like, how do you perceive veganism? Like, do you perceive it, which like my own fear deep down is that it is a first world folly, that it is kind of a meaningless thing. But I, like, how do you perceive veganism? Like both as a cuisine and as like this, movement.
Oh man. Okay. So as someone who has been a chef and someone who appreciates just the act of cooking, I find veganism and any sort of like restrictive cuisine, right, where like you are just, you have to exclude a certain category of foods as a rule. I find those really inspiring actually, because you have to be more creative, you know, like it's, this is why I hate steakhouses. I fucking abhor steakhouses. They're so boring. They're the worst. Because it's just like, it's just a meat. It's a steak.
Right.
It's like you salt and pepper it, you sear it, you're done. And it's just like, ugh, it's like so boring. And so like, you know, vegan food at its best is like extremely creative, right? Because it, you have to, as the chef or as the cook, appeal to someone for whom like the steak is potentially an alternative, an easy one. And so you have to appeal to the senses, and you have such a variety of things to choose from to do that. And, you know, bringing out like savory notes in like tomatoes or parsnips, just like, you know, vegetables and fruits is so, it's such a challenge. And so intellectually and just like as far as craft goes, I'm way more impressed with someone who can make a really good vegan meal than a omnivorous one.
Right, right.
Is that right to call it a meal of the omnivorous? I don't know.
I do.
Meat inclusive.
Meat inclusive.
One.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, but do you like do? We've talked about this a little, but you know, as a movement, like, do you have any thoughts on how veganism like functions in the world, kind of?
Yeah, it is like, I don't know. Like, I have a hard time personally because I have seen so many examples of vegan companies using really colonialist rhetoric.
Of course.
Especially when talking about indigenous foods, right? And especially, like, for example, there's a company that makes a vegan fish sauce. And, you know, they bandy themselves as, like, the first ones. And, like, look how gross the process of making fish sauce is. Why would anyone eat that? And, you know, there's pictures of, like, piles of dead anchovies, right? Which is, like, yeah, it's kind of yucky. But, like, it's what Vietnamese people eat every day, like the majority, right? Like, it is something that we honor and love and is like an integral part of our identity. And so like, I understand the tendency to, I don't know, like to be like, look at this great alternative to this thing that like you might be grossed out by. But gross is such a, you know, it's such a context-based thing. And also like they were erasing the work of Buddhist Vietnamese people who have made vegan fish sauce for like centuries. And so like, there's that part of it too, where it's just like, come on, like, you're not the first just because you have a nice label.
Right, right, right. No, that, veganism is built on labels, on cute labels. Yeah, no, I think that's awful. And when I, when, you know, the same thing, I've written a little bit about it, but like with tempeh or something like that, where people are like, look what we've created. And it's like, no, you've completely, you know, most vegans eat tempeh and then don't know that it's an Indonesian food. And that just seems so insane to me. And then there's, you know, there's so many issues, which like, I just talked to someone about, you know, different, you know, butters or alternative butters. And it's like, well, we have to be concerned with like the carbon footprint of that butter versus like, maybe if you live somewhere where butter is being made, maybe it would be better to eat the cow butter than the butter that was made in a facility that was, you know, thousands of miles away. You know, it's a, there's all these concerns that I hope become more of a conversation topic among vegans. But wow, I would, I need to look up that fish sauce.
I think there's like a PH in there. It's like fish sauce or something. I don't know, it's silly. Yeah. But yeah, like I'm totally behind veganism as like a political stance mm-hmm. and a set of principles. And, you know, I think if coupled with like, you know, like I don't believe it's essential or let me rephrase that. I don't believe it's possible to be conservative and vegan, right? Like, I don't think that that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to include veganism as like one facet of like a broader set of communitarian values that are like meant to uplift all people in the world and, you know, give everyone the means to control what they put in their bodies, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So for you, is cooking a political act?
I'd say yes. You know, the most surface level way that that is a political act to me is in terms of my own like sense of being a woman mm-hmm. and cooking. Because, you know, for so much of my career, that made me a minority mm-hmm. in the kitchen, right? Like in restaurants. People would assume that I was the pastry chef, right? Which is like, pastry is a fine category of cooking. It's just not what I was doing. But it is a category of cooking in which women are often siloed in mm-hmm. fine dining. And that's like an important part of the formation of that role and way we think about it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, being visible and doing what I did was political. Just cooking and just sticking it out with everyone else and keeping up and even being better than the men around me was really important to me.
Absolutely. Is there any way in beyond gender that you found it to be political?
Yeah. I mean, gosh, just in terms of like identity, which is such a corny thing to say, right? Like me cooking like Vietnamese and like Cantonese food is an important part of kind of hanging on to my family traditions, mm-hmm. you know, and like cementing my sense of identity within those things. And, you know, like I can't speak those languages mm-hmm. and I can't really converse with my grandparents, but I can make food that they recognize. And for me, that's really important. And it's so corny. I'm so sorry.
No, that's amazing.
Corny as fuck.
No, absolutely not. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was really good.
Oh, great.